You are listening to Mike Seminary and Friends,
a Q1 Network production.
If you have dreams or you're wondering how to make a bigger impact in this world, you're home. Welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends. I'm Deb, Mike's wife. I suggested this idea as a way to keep him busy and out of my way after he retired. So far, it's working. Thanks for listening. It's time for Mike Seminary and Friends.
Welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends, the place where we strive to make a difference, a positive difference, provide you something of value. Heck, from my perspective, we just want to share good stuff. I'm your host, Mike Seminary, and I'm so grateful you've joined us. A big thanks to my friend David Hansen for my theme music, Continental Drift. Search for his work, Serotonin Waters and Moon Dot Soup, on iTunes and Spotify. By the way, I appreciate your comments and guest suggestions. Keep them coming at MikeSeminary.com or Mike Seminary and Friends on Facebook. And please visit us at Apple Podcasts and leave a review. Today, I am so honored to have as my guest an individual that prior to making his decision to not seek re-election in late 2019, he had the distinction of serving as the Chief Justice of North Dakota Supreme Court longer than any of his predecessors. And I think there's 40 plus of those. And I believe he is now also the longest serving statewide elected official. Chief Justice Gerald Vandewalt. Chief, welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends. Thank you for taking time to join me. How are you today?
Well, thank you, Mike. I'm doing fairly well. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much. And by the way, thank you for serving on the Supreme Court as the Chief Justice for, I think, a 26, 29 years. It's a bunch.
It's a bunch. But I tell you, Mike, one thing I want to make clear is that prior to, well, sometime in the 60s, I guess, the Chief Justice only served two-year terms. It says the Chief Justice, the Constitution says the Chief Justice shall be chosen as provided by law. Law said the person serving on the Supreme Court with the shortest term would serve as Chief Justice. That meant 2 years before you were up for re-election, you served as Chief Justice. It wasn't until that was changed and Ralph Eichstädt became the chief. He served for about 20 years, and then I came along. So I'm only the second one that's had the opportunity to do that.
Okay. What prompted that change?
Well, I suspect that Chief Justice Eichstädt approached the legislature and said, say, we should change this, because every 2 years, that meant there was no continuity of chief justices. And administratively, from a ceremonial standpoint, it doesn't make any difference. From an administrative standpoint, it makes a lot of difference.
Sure.
Whether you serve 2 years or 10 years. So every 2 years was not a much continuity for a chief justice on the administrative side. And our Constitution says Chief Justice is the chief administrative officer of this court system. So that's why.
Well, thank you for that clarification. So you were born in Noonan, North Dakota. And when you were born there, I suppose it was somewhere around 500 people. How did a young fellow from Noonan make his way to UND for education? What prompted you as a kid growing up to say, I've got to get to Grand Forks to go to college?
Well, there was never any doubt that I was going to go to college. My parents both decided that my brother and I were going to go to college. So the only question was where. And we had a superintendent of, there were 10 graduating kids in my class, 50 in high school. We had a superintendent that was very college-minded. And three of us out of the class of 10 went to UND. And well, that was it.
Well, at UND, you had a Bachelor of Science in Commerce from the School of Business.
Yes.
Was by chance, was Tom Clifford the dean at that time?
Yes.
Prompted me to ask that question as I saw the time frame. You were probably close to the same time that my uncle was in that school. He later became a chief executive of a hospital, by the way.
Was he teaching or going to school?
No, he was a student.
Well, he was a student. Okay.
James Sauer is his name.
Oh, all right. That name sounds somewhat familiar, Mike. I have to look it up. He wasn't an accounting major, I don't think so.
No, I don't believe so.
Yeah. That name sounds familiar, though. We knew one another pretty well on that campus. It was much smaller then than it is now. So,
what prompted you to, or to, even back in Noonan through junior high and high school, did you know that law was in your future?
No, I had no idea. I didn't know what a lawyer was, except that there was one in Crosby. He raised potatoes, and my mother's debate coach had been a lawyer. She took English. She went to Crosby High School, and the English teacher's husband was a lawyer, and he taught the debate. He coached the debate team. My mother was a statewide debate champion, but I had no idea what a lawyer did. No interest in it at all at that stage.
What happened at UND when you decided, I think this is the career path for me, I'm going to go to law school?
Well, I was an accounting major, and I hit the business law course, and I hit an instructor that was wonderful, and he changed my life. I took 1 year of first semester, I had business law. I thought, this is it. Because I was debating on accounting. I liked accounting. Didn't like numbers that well, but then I hit business law, and it was a required course, and Louis Kulis taught the course, and it was wonderful. And I, from then on, about 2 weeks in, I thought, this is what I want to do. So that was, at least this is what I want to study, I thought. I don't know what I wanted to do with the degree.
What did you do after graduating from law school?
Well, I had a job with a firm in Williston set up, and the dean came in and said, talk to the firm, they're going to wait a year. We want you to go to Bismarck. We send a student every year, the attorney general's office in Bismarck, and you're it. And I said, fine. This was the 50s. We did what we were told, and I wasn't that interested really in going home anyhow. I knew I'd always be that Vandewall kid up there. And so I said, sure, I'll take it. And I went for a year. And during the course of that year, the attorney general, I applied for a special position, asked the legislature, 58 and 59, asked the 59 legislature for a special position, special assistant attorney general to advise the Industrial Commission on oil and gas. He knew that's what I was interested in, and offered me the position, and I took it.
And then in 75, you were appointed the first assistant attorney general of North Dakota. That must have been was it Governor Al Olson then?
No, the first assistant, of course, the attorney general appoints the first assistant. Al Olson was the attorney general, yeah.
Attorney general, okay.
And the governor was Art Link.
And then you were appointed to the Supreme Court, August of 1978.
Yes.
Ran successfully six times as Chief Justice.
Well, I didn't run as Chief Justice. I had to run for the court. I was appointed in 78, and right. the term was up in 78. So I had about 3 weeks to get my 300 signatures to get on the ballot. And so I ran, and I was opposed. I already had an opponent who had filed in 78. And then that was for the unexpired term, I guess. That's not a term, it was an unexpired term. And I had to run again in 84, 94, 2004, 2014. Now the Constitution has been amended since then, and it says that you can serve 2 years before you have to run. So if that had been in effect when I was appointed, I wouldn't have had to run until 1980. But since it wasn't, and there was time, I had to run in 78. As I said, at that time the primary was in September, not in June, and so I had to file and run in the primary, and then again in November.
Well, you were the Chief Justice, a pretty
significant change came about regarding county judges and converting the judiciary in North Dakota to a single tier system. What, and just for the sake of Mike Seminary listeners and followers, prior to that, there was a judge in every county. What prompted that change, and what was your role during the time of that change?
Well, the groundwork had been pretty well laid by my predecessor for it. He got the change through the legislature. I implemented it. But yes, you're right, Mike, that there was a judge in every county. And we did not have a unified system. We now have a unified judicial system. So from top to bottom, it's pretty well unified. Every judge is under for administrative purposes under the Chief Justice, except municipal judges, and they are elected on their own. But it was pretty well laid out, and that was the mood then. And you know, there were lots of pluses to it. We became more efficient, but we lost some things along the way. We lost, as an example, county judges. Some of them had to be lawyers, some didn't. It depended on the size of the county. And if you were in a county that didn't have to be a lawyer, very often we had a lay county judge. Those county judges dealt primarily with probate matters. And they became experts in probate. Now we have generalist judges that are, as I've said about myself, I came to the court with certain expertise. I know nothing about expertise anymore. I'm a generalist now, as are most trial judges now. They have to be generalists because they deal with everything. We don't have a criminal division. We don't have a civil division. We don't have a probate division, family law division. They have to take all the cases that are assigned to them in any of those areas.
You mentioned that as a result of this change, there were some efficiencies. Mm-hmm. What were some of the most significant efficiencies as a result of that transformation?
Well, we did away with the county judges, for one thing. And secondly, for instance, a county judge could take a plea, but he couldn't hear the case. So very often you'd have a district judge traveling to a county to try a case that the county judge could have taken a plea in, but couldn't because he didn't have a jurisdiction over the case.
That must have also been about the time when computerization, which was impacting everything, of course, must have made a significant change for how the judicial system was operating. Am I correct?
Well, I really think that came a little later, Mike. I'm no computer expert by any means, and Justice Dale Sandstrom is the one that started the computer revolution when he came in, and it certainly has been continued by Justice Tufte, Justice Chief Justice Jensen, Justice Crothers are all much more computer oriented than I am. But I would say that it began really a few years later. We may have been behind the boat because of me, perhaps, but it certainly started playing a part in a role in it, but not as significant then as it is now. We're becoming a paperless court now. Back then it was all paper, of course.
I'm going to shift gears here and talk a little bit about your involvement on a national basis through the Chief Justices Association of the American Bar Association. How many years have you been involved with the Chief Justices Association, and you were also chief of the Chief Justices Association? How many years did you have that involvement and were recognized by your peers at that level?
Well, certainly starting in 2000, the year I became the chief in, 1993, I guess it was. And from then on, I'd been involved with it. You're automatically a member when you become Chief Justice. And so I missed the first meeting because 1993 was a legislative session, and the meeting started about 2 weeks after our legislature started. And I don't care how long I'd been around, and I'd been around a while by that time, I was not prepared really for the onslaught of the state of the judiciary and all everything that came with being the Chief Justice. So I missed the first meeting, but from then on, I was at every meeting, I think, of CCJ.
It was during that time that Ethics 2000, a rewrite of the code of ethics for American lawyers, mm-hmm. was underway. How was your hand involved in that transformation, and what caused it?
Well, I don't know that I had a hand in it. I certainly was one of the participants. All participants have a hand. I think that there was a lot of things. First of all, I chaired the session on legal education the year after I chaired the Chief Justices Association, which, by the way, and that's the section that deals with the accreditation of law schools and that type of thing. So part of that was there. Part of it was an interest in ethics, of course, and Ethics 2000 came along and appointed the commission, and it was an interesting time. I don't know if I've answered your question.
No, you did. Thank you. See, if you were the Chief Justice for 26 years, is there another Chief Justice of a state Supreme Court that has served 26 years or longer that you're aware of?
Well, I suspect there is. I know one of them that probably did was Harry Caracol from Virginia. He was there when I came in, and he wasn't there when I left, but he was in his middle 90s, and he'd been there for a long time, Chief Justice of Virginia for a long time. I don't know if the National Center has any statistics on that or not, but it's the case by state-by-state basis, of course, as you know.
Who are some of your mentors or individuals that influenced you along your career path?
Oh, man. Starting way back when in high school or college or when, or in after I became a lawyer.
I'm going to say after you became a lawyer, and maybe even zeroed in a little bit more after you became involved as at the Attorney General's office and then in the Supreme Court.
Okay. Well, certainly I'd have to give Helge Johannesson, who was Attorney General. I didn't join the office. Les Burgum was the Attorney General when I joined the office, but Helge then became Attorney General. He's the one that really gave me the opportunities to move around. I not only had oil and gas, I had education portfolios, I had the retirement portfolio, I had lots of portfolios in addition to writing opinions. Now they're much more stratified in the Attorney General's office. Back then you did a lot of things, and he gave me the opportunity to do it. He'd be one of the first. Paul Sand, there's any number of them. I'm going to admit, I hate to start because I'm going to omit some that I have been dead for a few years and I've forgotten, but have been wonderful people, and I learned from all of them, and I'm still learning today. I think the day I quit learning is the day I'm out of that court, because of that.
That's important for all of us. The minute you stop learning or stop taking information, probably not a good sign. We don't want to go there.
No.
What are some of the most powerful or profound memories for you during the time as Chief Justice? And you don't have to go into case specifically, but what were some of those powerful memories that you have?
Well, one of the powerful memories I have is when Vernon Peterson had resigned and Paul Sand died unexpectedly, and we had two vacancies on the court, and there was an issue between Governor Olson and Governor Sinner, I guess, to who was going to fill those positions, and that was a traumatic situation. I suppose one of the other ones I'd have to concede is when I joined the court in August of 1978, I had been challenged by Fred Sefke, a local attorney, who said I'd violated the ethics on the election law by allowing. I had my picture taken in the courtroom, and unknowns to me, they plugged in the person that took the picture, plugged in a light bulb into the electricity of the court and said I was using state property for election purposes, which of course was prohibited. So I had to overcome that. And once I got beyond that, it took about a year to get that settled. And then from then on, it became a little more settled. But as far as the Chief Justice position is concerned, I think that I was immediately, as we talked earlier, I was immediately faced with the proposition of implementing the unified system. And it was difficult because we had to eliminate judges under that system. We had what, 26 county judges and 20-some district judges, a total of 53 judges. We had to reduce them to 42. We were to do it by attrition. And if we couldn't do it by attrition, then we had to just say to some people, you can't run for election. Fortunately, we were able to accomplish it by attrition, but it was a difficult time period, very frankly.
You are an election law expert, and you know that's a big, and we won't go into great detail here, but that's a big topic as of late. What prompted you to zero in on election law and why that became a passion for you during your profession?
Well, I don't know that I zeroed in on it. I was required the Secretary of State's office. I was one of my portfolios, and they requested information about election issues. And I was almost forced to. I loved it, don't get me wrong, but it was not something I chose. It was one of the portfolios I had. And that's where I became, an expert. I became interested in election laws, I'll say that. But it was through the Secretary of State's office that happened. As you may know, the Attorney General is the advisor, legal advisor of all state agencies. And so whenever there was a question, they would come to the Attorney General. So they didn't have their own private counsel. Now, some of them had special assistants within their department. But even those people had to consult with the Attorney General's office on the big issues. So that was where that came in.
I meant to ask you this question early on when it was a given that you were going to go to college after high school, both you and your brother. Were there other colleges or universities that were on the list of consideration other than UND?
By my parents, there were not on my list. My mother would have preferred that I go to St. Thomas. She was from Minneapolis. Her family, her cousins and so forth, had gone to St. Kate's and St. Thomas. And my dad would have preferred Minot, perhaps. My brother did go to Minot for 2 years, and then he went to NDSU. I decided I wanted to go from the smallest school in the state to the biggest. And they frankly were worried that I was taking too big a step. It was going to be too hard for me with all these people. I was used to, in a small town, you know, you answered everybody, and they were concerned about my being able to, whether I'd sink or swim in a so-called big environment. Well, I did. I was fine. But that's what I decided early on. I wanted to try out what I considered to be big, and it was big. And by my standards, now most people would laugh at that, but it was big by my standards. So that was it.
What kind of an influence in your education did Tom Clifford have?
Well, Tom, of course, had been the dean of the School of Business. We called the School of Business when I was there. And he subsequently became president, and certainly he had his mark. He was an accounting major. He was an accountant. So the accounting department, I think, was his favorite spot. And certainly he made sure it was well populated with great instructors. And Mr. Copenhaver was the head of the department, but he had Louis Kulis and Jack Staples and some other people that were there. And so he's the one that really did the job, I think. I really didn't get to know Tom until later on, about 1960, 61. The higher education staff had asked for some help. And one of the assistant commissioner of higher ed was a man that had taken cost accounting from a UND. And so Helge Johannes said, you want to take that? And I said, sure, I'd love it. And from then on, higher ed became a passion. And then Tom became president, of course, and that type of thing. So that's when I really got to know Tom and really appreciate what he'd done for UND and for the state of North Dakota.
Chief, the main courtroom at the law school in Grand Forks is named after you. What did that mean to you?
Well, it's the dedication is to take place this Friday, formal dedication, as I understand it. I was swept off my feet by the announcement came at a meeting, a thing that UND held in Bismarck, what, in February of 2020, I guess. And I was startled then, and at first I thought, well, come on now. You know, when I was in law school, that room was the art department. There was no courtroom in the law school at that stage. So that's subsequent. Mr. Baker was named the Baker Moot Courtroom, was from Montana, apparently. He was not a lawyer. He gave money for it. So my first impression was, well, what happened to Mr. Baker? You know, easy come, easy go on these names. And I expect that maybe 20 years or less from now, it'll be renamed some other for someone else. I think it's fine. I'm very happy with it. I'm proud of it. I'm trying to be humble about it, but I'm very proud of it.
Well, I think it's appropriately done, and I think it's just wonderful and well-deserved recognition, by the way. Chief, I run, or I should say I have run, with a lot of lawyers during my 45 plus years I've been running. I know a lot of attorneys because of just being involved in business for the number of years I have been involved until my retirement. And you are held in the highest regard, Chief. There isn't a person that just doesn't have very profound, glowing comments and praise for you. And I've learned over time that isn't just necessarily what you've done at the Supreme Court level. It's also at that State Bar Association level where you have been very, very involved for a few years. And so you've been very connected to the members of that profession for a long time. How do you balance the time, frankly, and maybe it's just a priority thing, where State Bar Association, very, very busy schedule at the Supreme Court level. How do you balance the time requirement to be so involved?
Well, first of all, let me say it's what you've said. I sweeps me off my feet a little bit. I'm not so sure. I couldn't find a few people that would disagree with you on that, but I'll take it, Mike. Thank you very much for your kind words. As far as the time balance is concerned, as you know, I'm not married. I have no children, so I've been able, I had my mother with me till she was 103. She died about, 15 years ago. And that took up some time, but it was during my busy time in the court, I should say, too. But I was able to do it, and I was pleased to do it. The relationship between the bar and the bench had not always been great in North Dakota, and I did want to improve that, and I tried hard. And I hope I succeeded somewhat. We used to have separate committees. For instance, the bar would have a separate committee on rules, and the court had one. And whenever something came, we'd have to go through both committees. We did away with that. We have one joint committee. We call it the Joint Procedures Committee. And some of those things. And I wanted the profession. I was a member of the profession. And by law, we have to be members of the profession. Judges have to be lawyers in order to become a judge. And if you're a lawyer, you must be a member of the bar. And that's a bar association. That's what North Dakota requires. And it's been advantageous for both groups, I think. And it's something that I cherish very much, is my relationship with the members of the bar. So I think that that's probably the reason that I am. Well, let me just say that I think the relationships improved perhaps between bench and the bar after I became, and I did work on it hard. I wanted it to become a good relationship. I think it has been. I hope it continues that way.
It's been a while since I've seen you walking. To let people know that you've always taken good care of your health. And it wasn't too long ago that I saw you all the time walking. Mm-hmm. And just about COVID time, I miss you out in the street, Chief. I miss seeing you out there.
Believe me, I miss being out there myself. right now I've got my, I fell and banged up a knee. So I've got a knee that's swollen right now. Can barely walk at all. But it's one of those things that you take for granted, Mike. And it's not until it's gone that you miss it. And I was able to resolve a lot of problems in my head by walking, just forgetting about everything else, just looking around and seeing people's yards and seeing some of the things. And then I started thinking about some of the issues I had, and some of them just simply resolved themselves during that walk. So I do miss it, but I don't know if I'll ever get back to it. Probably not to the extent I was, but I'm trying hard to do it. So
you mentioned that you've never been married, don't have kids. I don't know that I necessarily knew that, but so the profession of law in many ways has been your wife, your family. It appears to me it's been a profound joy for you, the profession that you chose and the colleagues that you're surrounded with and by. Is that a pretty accurate observation, that you take great joy and pride in your profession?
Absolutely, I do. I certainly do. And I don't want to mislead people that might think, well, I'm a loner. My brother, I had one brother, he was 7 years older than I was. He had rheumatic fever as a kid, and it damaged his heart valves considerably, and he died in his middle 40s after open heart surgery in Mayo to replace the valve. That was in the 60s, and that wasn't common surgery at that time. He left two daughters, one of whom lives in Bismarck, married to a lawyer, and they have two children, and one of my niece's daughter is a dentist. She and her husband are both dentists here. And they have the three most important people in my life right now, my two great-great nephews and a great-great niece. So they are, I do have some fam here close. So that's very nice.
Chief, if you had a magic wand that you could wave over the heads of youngsters living in small rural towns anywhere, it doesn't have to be North Dakota, it's anywhere. And like you, they aspire to go on to a four-year education institution. And I'm saying it that way because there clearly are a lot of opportunities outside of a four-year higher ed calling. There are great technical and trade schools and two-year institutions, and there are professions you can be involved in where it doesn't even necessarily require education beyond high school. But for those youngsters, particularly in rural settings, that aspire to go on to a four-year higher ed institution, what's the one thing you'd want them to know about that pursuit?
What you say is very interesting, Mike, because as I think I said at the beginning, we had a superintendent that was very, we were all going to go to college in his mind. We're all going to get four-year degrees. He was one of the old school. He could come into the English class and say, what are you studying? And we'd tell him he could pick it up and recite it, come in the math class, whatever it was. The people that he really didn't speak to too much was the vocational people. And we had a couple of people in our class that one of them became he drew cartoons for the Denver Post. He made a fortune doing that. And he always was great. He used to sit behind me and he'd scribble out these cartoons. While I was studying, he was doing that. I thought, well, you're wasting your time. He wasn't. He was honing his own. So I do respect very much the non-professional people. I say non-professional because I'm talking about law and medicine, that type of thing. But so I respect them. And you're right. I think the emphasis now is more switching away from the four-year degree to the more practical aspects of education. But if I was going to advise them, I'd say, know what you're doing. And I was, my judgment was not very good. We now know that judgment in people doesn't develop until some people in their late 20s. That's why when you get in a car with a young person whose reactions are so much better than yours, you fear for your life. It's not his or her ability to drive the car. It's the judgment in doing so that you're concerned about, really. And so that would be the one thing I'd say, make sure you know what you're doing before you do it. Now, you can always switch. Of course, with me, I only had two jobs in my life, one in the AG's office and one in the court. But and now that's much different. People have changed jobs 3 or 4 times in a lifetime. But so I would say that the best thing for them to do is to do something that they want to do that will sustain them for the rest of their life. Can't imagine anything worse than being stuck in a job that you hate, but you can't financially do anything else except work at that job. That would be terrible as far as I was concerned.
That's a great answer, great advice, by the way. I'm going to ask a similar question. Same magic wand. Now you're going to be able to wave it over the heads of young attorneys and lawyers who have aspirations to become either a district judge, or let's be maybe more specific, a Supreme Court judge. What's the one piece of advice you'd like to share with them?
Well, I don't know that you have to be in the right place at the right time, and you have to be prepared. So be prepared would be the best advice I could give. There are some people that would want to be, my blood runs a little cold when someone says, well, I want to be a judge. Well, I never wanted to be a judge, particularly. I didn't set out to be one. But when the opportunity came, I was ready and I took it. And so that, I think, is the most important thing. But you have to be in the right place at the right time. And I happened to be, and I was ready to seize the moment, and I did. And so I would say, be prepared. Keep your reputation clean, for heaven's sake. And be sure that you are a student of the law, and don't pretend that you're not, because you need to be a student of the law.
Boy, I just thought of something, Chief, and that again is great advice. In terms of maintaining good character nowadays, it seems to be there are cameras everywhere, the ability to record conversations everywhere. People have long memories, and we're living at a time where we sometimes are awfully critical of someone's background, sometimes rightly so, sometimes maybe not so much. And so, to your point, being a person of great character, consistency is critically, it's important in every profession, but particularly this one. I'm going to go back to something you had mentioned in terms of changes and profound and powerful memories. Whenever there's change, and the one that you had mentioned was that there had to be elimination of some of those positions that you referenced. Whenever there's change, there are great benefits, good consequences. Sometimes there are unintended consequences. Are there any other examples of where change, either because of technology or some legislative matter, or whatever the case might be, had to be implemented that had any negative unintended consequences during your career?
Well, let's go right to COVID. I think that it has had some. We've been forced, I work from home for a while because that, and many of our staff did. They were required to, they had to. And some of them really loved it, and I think that's fine. But I think that, and I worry about their replacements. Those people knew the mores of the court. They knew they had established relationships with their fellow employees. I know how a new person coming on does that. Now, I consider that a negative. Maybe someone will say, oh, no, you can do it this way, that way. Perhaps that is the answer. But I am concerned about the esprit de corps of the judicial system. I'm concerned about the relationship among the judges and justices. I haven't gone to a meeting, Mike, that I learned during the meeting, but I learned as much in between sessions, that sometimes at dinner at night or sometimes over coffee, just talking with other people, that I learned more than I did during the session. Those things are not going to be possible. Now, for they say, well, we have chat rooms and things like that. Maybe that will. I'm just not used to it, perhaps. But I do worry about that. I think that's a negative effect. Now, the positive effect is you get a lot more work done. You don't have to stop everything. The system still goes on. So from the public standpoint, I think it's a big benefit. but I hope that it doesn't undermine the system itself.
That's a good point. COVID has forced us to deal with change that maybe it was coming. I'm not sure. I've had the opportunity to visit with a lot of individuals that have HR responsibilities in companies, some of them very large, and particularly companies that have a big footprint where they might have offices and employees and team members in 15, 20 or more states. And with the culture of each state being different and the ages and backgrounds and cultural differences just in employees, this HR issue as a result of COVID is very, very significant. There are a lot of employees that have no interest going back, want to keep working remotely. There are companies that think that they should be coming back, but are also dealing with the reality that when you have talented people that can get the work done almost anywhere, make sure you find a way to keep them. And so you're going to have to deal with those COVID consequences, as you just mentioned. What are some of your hobbies, Chief?
Well, I love playing bridge. I was a competitive bridge player. I traveled around quite a bit. I'm a life master. I don't play bridge much anymore because I can't. My eyesight's not that great. And very frankly, that was a time limit that I had to put the bridge aside, at least traveling. And so that was one of them. I love gardening. I love raising flowers. I'm not sure I'm into gardens as such, but I love raising flowers. My dad did the same thing. Work in the field or outside all day and come home. He had beautiful flower gardens, which was unusual for a farmer, at least in Noonan it was. So I loved reading, and that's also becoming more difficult. But and I have to read a lot, so I don't get to read the things I want to. I have to read briefs and things like that. But those are some of my best hobbies.
I see every once in a while that Bell May, who's taking in culture and arts and music, sure appreciate that as well, Chief.
Oh, yes. Yes, I love that. Love that. I missed the symphony last night because of my leg. I didn't want to walk down and think I couldn't sit for 2 hours, but I'll be back at it. Yes, I do.
Well, Chief, I want to thank you so much for taking time to join me today on Mike Seminary and Friends. Fortuitous, in my opinion, that we accidentally ended up on a phone call a couple of weeks ago, and I'd been thinking about how I'd like to get you on my podcast, and by golly, we got it done. So thank you so much for taking time to join me. Thank you for the years of remarkable service to the state of North Dakota and her citizens. You've been a remarkable individual. Chief, appreciate you so much. You have a great day. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for everything you've offered me, Mike. It was a fortuitous phone call. I think I misdialed, perhaps, and I got you, and I was apologizing. You mentioned this, and I thought, well, that's interesting, and I'd like to do that. And so, and as far as I want to thank the people in North Dakota for allowing me to do this. North Dakota is a great state, and I love it.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you for joining us today. You are profoundly appreciated. Where would I be without the team at Q1 Network? Anna DeVere, Ashley Harris, Bo Hastings, and Marlo Anderson. And my wife, Deb. Deb really orchestrates all of this for me. I have an incredible wife, partner, and friend. Thanks again for listening to Mike Seminary and Friends. Until we chat again, love y'all.